Hello, I'm Barry Daniel, and this is the podcast of the Middle Way Society. Our aim is to encourage a universal approach to living a more integrated, ethical life, avoiding dogma or any appeal to authority. We are joined today by British author and journalist Toby Jones. Toby was educated at Jesus College, Oxford, and then worked at the London Review of Books and The Independent on Sunday. He's a best-selling author, and his books include The Dark Heart of Italy, Utopian Dreams, and Blood on the Altar. He moved to Parma in Italy in 1999, returning to the UK in 2004. Toby and his wife now manage a 10-acre woodland shelter near Shepton Mallet, Somerset, called Windsor Hill Wood. The sanctuary is the subject of his seventh book, A Place of Refuge, and this will be the topic of our discussion today. Hello, Toby. Welcome to the Middle Way Society podcast.
Hi, thank you.
Okay, well, maybe could we begin by you telling us a bit more about your background and what prompted you to establish Windsor Hill Wood?
Well, we're Christians.
Yeah.
And you know, I think if you believe the Gospels and want to follow Jesus, I think you've got to do it all or nothing. And I think a lot of people sort of possibly don't do it fully. And we thought this is a very clear calling. This is how we want to try and follow Jesus. So that's the main inspiration, really.
Yeah. OK. And then why did you want the refuge to be in woodland rather than in traditional agricultural land?
Well, I know enough about sort of livestock farming to know how hard work it is. And I think the thing about woodland, apart from the obvious beautiful aesthetic value of it, is that it's a very healing, soothing environment.
Yeah.
It's a very sort of primeval cradle for the human soul. And I knew we wanted to heat the house with wood, heat the water with wood. I knew we wanted to make furniture, sell furniture. So it just seemed that anything woodland based made sense. And you don't have 5 a.m. milking, you know.
So it was partly that the project could be, in a sense, more sustainable. You thought you could make it more workable financially that way as well.
Well, finance is another question. You know, no one's ever accused me of being a demon businessman, I'm afraid. Sustainable, yes. You know, I mean, it's lovely to be able to heat your house and the water with wood. I think that's an amazing thing. And it creates a lot of very unskilled manual labour, which is, you know, what we do together here. That's when the best chats happen, you know, when people are chopping wood together.
Yeah, great. OK. In the book, I read that your wife, Francesca, insisted that it had to be a family home first. Why was that?
Well, I think we travelled to a lot of communities, lived on a lot of communities, and many of them were slightly institutionalised. And, you know, most of the people coming to us, because it was set up for people whose lives were in some way broken, you know, they'd hit the buffers in one way or another. Many of them had come from prisons or hostels or bedsits or rehabs or these sort of possibly lonely, neutral, institutionalised places. And we just realised very early on that a family setting is what most people need. And I think in some communities, so no one looks after it. She was very clear that it was our family home and it was going to be hopefully well ordered and clean and, you know, honest, rather than possibly, I don't know, a slightly more, like I say, institutionalised, neutral feel to it.
Okay. And again, in the book, you talk about the nuclear family to an extent, and to some degree that can be problematic. Could you expand on that a little bit?
Well, I think the nuclear family is really an invention of sort of 20th century Western world.
Okay.
I don't know that until the 20th century there was such an idealisation of a unit of 3, 4, 5 human beings living together. And you know, it's great for capitalism. Nuclear family is great for capitalism because we all need a dishwasher and we all need, don't need, but a lot of people are told they need a TV. And, you know, the more we're divided into these little units, the more we're forced to consume. And actually, I think it creates a lot of stresses for both the children and the parents living in that way. And you know, I think there's something very natural about growing up in an intergenerational way with lots of people who may or may not be family at the centre or on the fringes and coming in and out. I think it's a very organic way to bring up children.
Presumably with your wife being from Italy, you had some experience of that anyway with her side of the family. In Italy, did their families tend to be a bit more extended?
Yeah, I mean, it's very common. I mean, it's almost a truism, isn't it, of Italian society that children stay at home well into their 30s or 40s, and they often have flats in the same block. And it causes problems and arguments and claustrophobia, maybe, but I think that the pros far outweigh the cons, really.
Yeah, okay. To what extent would you say the book is a guide to communal living? How much of that was your intention?
Well, it's probably a guide of what not to do in some ways, because we made so many mistakes. I mean, we didn't reinvent the wheel. We were very influenced by the Pilsden community in Bridport and by various other communities like Larsh and Emmaus and Camp Hill and so on and so forth. So we weren't reinventing the wheel, but we were doing it off our own bat, and we made lots of mistakes. So the book sort of chronicles the mistakes. It's not a book about us knowing how to do it and then doing it. It's very much sort of almost trying to build the ship after you've set sail, which is difficult and fraught with risks and tensions, but creates a great sense of togetherness. You know, I think everyone who lived here hopefully felt they were always involved in discussions. Things were consensual, if not unanimous. We spoke about so many things together as we sort of created the space together and created the buildings together.
And that was the plan from the beginning, wasn't it? In a sense that you had this idea for it to evolve, for the thing to grow organically.
Yeah, I mean, it was the plan, and it worked on the whole.
I know every day is different, Toby, but in terms of routine, could you, just in sort of rough brushstrokes, could you give an idea how a typical day there is structured?
Yeah, so, you know, we share all our meals. Some of us go to chapel at 7:30 in the morning. Breakfast is staggered, so that's, you know, each to his own, really. But 9 a.m. we'll meet up around the big table in the garden room, do a quick feelings check, so everyone says how they're feeling. And it might just be one or two words, and we don't delve much deeper, but we do know if someone's feeling, you know, anxious or furious or nervous or whatever it is. And then we'll sort of work out what jobs need doing between then and lunch. And, you know, it could be anything from pig fencing to planting an orchard to chopping wood to cooking the lunch, or someone will always be on bread duty. Back to chapel at 12:30 for those who want. Lunch at 1, afternoon off, evening tea at 6:30. Kids are at school, so the evening meal, you know, it's a bit noisier than the others. And there are different things that happen through the week. So Thursday we do a cleaning hour for an hour and a half. Everyone helps clean all the communal areas. And then we have a long well-being meeting. I mean, I always say the good time to come to lunch is on a Thursday lunchtime. You've done an hour and a half's cleaning, you've done a 2-hour well-being meeting, everyone's feeling sort of, you know, purged and hopefully got things off their chest. So, and then Friday's off. So it's a very, very sort of structured but gentle working week, really.
Yeah. What about play? Did you manage to fit that in?
Yeah, well, plays, I've become very interested, as you'll know if you've read A Place of Refuge, very interested in the role of play. And, you know, although almost everyone who comes here is in a pickle, it's actually a very cheerful place. And so, you know, when we're working together, there's a lot of laughter, a lot of banter. And, you know, we have endless amounts of board games and musical instruments. And, you know, looking out the window now, I can see a trampoline and a football pitch and a table tennis table and a badminton net. So it's endless sort of endless play. I mean, the whole thing in a way is playful,
yeah,
in a quite serious way as well as a sort of a frivolous way. So yeah, people learn about rules and fairness and discipline, and you know, there are good lessons in play, aren't there?
Yeah, and the, you mentioned rules. How did your ground rules evolve? Is that going back to what you were saying earlier, that it was quite a difficult process?
It was difficult in as much as you know, you don't think that you'll have to put on there, you know, don't skin the Jones's cat.
Yeah.
You know, that never happened. That's a silly example. Yeah. But, you know, you don't think you have to list all the things that shouldn't be done. And then as years went by, you know, we added things like there mustn't be any pornography on site, mustn't be any gambling on site, there'll be no swearing in the house. You know, the subtler things, when the big things were already set, so, you know, it was always a dry house, say always a dry house, it, you know, in the first year it became a dry house when it became apparent that a lot of people coming to us were in recovery. But yeah, it's the little things that were harder, the things you didn't expect to have to become a stickler about.
Yeah. No, that makes sense. But how did you sort of achieve the balance between rules and spontaneity, or is that a constant juggling act?
Yeah, I mean, that's what you're talking about on the middle way. That was always a very, very difficult one to balance because, you know, on the one hand, we were living with people who, as they admitted themselves, you know, would rush headfirst into any boundary that was ever set and had been rule breakers all their lives. And that's perhaps why they ended up with addiction issues or whatever other issues they had. And yet there were plenty of circumstances in which I had to go against, you know, the very black and white rules that we had on the communal notice. I mean, to give you an example, we, you know, in year three or four, decided it would be a rule that there could be no money lending between people here, because there were always people trying to blag a quid or two. And if you've lent 2 quid to Kevin, then, you know, when Gary asks if he can have a five, you kind of have to say that because otherwise he thinks you prefer them. And
yeah.
So you say no money lending, but then someone who's been living with you for 6 months says, oh, you know, we live miles from a cash point, says, oh, can you give me a couple of quid for this or that? You know, you do. And it can come back to haunt you if then further down the line, a grand has been slushing between A and B. And, you know, so that's an example of just one of many of when it did need flexibility and it also needed absolute cast iron rules at the same time. And we always had people who were either side of me, the people who were incredibly strict law abiders and couldn't be anything else because they were, perhaps they were, you know, autistic or perhaps for religious reasons or whatever it was, they were in recovery, they couldn't have any flexibility. And other people who thought, well, this is, you know, a family home doesn't have these absurd rules that if you're a minute late for tea, you have to go and eat in your own bedroom or something. We never did that. But, you know, the rehab is, by its nature, very, very strict. And we were, in part, trying to be a rehab as well as being a family home.
Yeah.
So yeah, it was a tough one to juggle.
Okay. What would you say is the hardest part of offering hospitality?
Oh, dear. I mean, how long have you got? I mean, I think I struggled with some very small but serious things like hygiene. You know, we all shared the cooking rota. We all went on bread duty. We all go to the loo, you know. So if there's someone who you know just isn't washing their hands, or if you know someone's got an unpleasant habit, then that I found difficult. And it's a tiny thing. You know, you would think it would be about the theology or the, you know, the geopolitical situation or... But it wasn't for me. I mean, I think it was about hygiene. It was about sort of more serious, difficult things were perhaps like.
What about your own limitations? What about showing your own fallibility?
Yeah, I think, well, that's just what I was going to say. Yeah, I think it's about you see your own imperfections every day.
Yeah.
And you don't only see them yourself. You often invariably have someone else pointing them out to you. And that's hard. You know, if you live by yourself, you can be pretty close to perfect, probably.
Yeah.
Or you hit yourself, you are.
But it was something that I really liked about the book, Toby, it was a real warts and all account of the experience, and you really don't hold back, especially about yourself. I presumably through the whole experience, you've got to know yourself a lot better.
Yeah, I think I have. I mean, it's very hard, isn't it, to sort of put in a few sentences the experience of 6 or 7 years, you know. But I think, like I said at the end of the book, I think it's made me both more sympathetic towards people, but also, I'm afraid, slightly more sceptical or cynical about them. I've become tougher, I suppose. You know, I think my fault at the beginning was to always see the best in people with quite, you know, painful consequences. And now I sort of ask some pretty tough questions, and I'm afraid take a slightly dimmer view of the world or of human nature. But I still think that sort of throwing open your doors allows far more good than bad in. You know, I think there are so many good people wanting to open the doors. And, you know, there are bad apples, but they're far fewer than the good ones. And I've become better at weeding them out, I'm afraid.
Yeah, I think there was also seemed a turning point in the book when you were struggling for a while, but then you got like a sort of management committee, and they really helped you see that, you know, you need to take as much your needs into account in order for it to work. There was a balance there that you seem to have found that very helpful, that you've got someone looking from the outside, had a sort of wider perspective at times of what was going on.
Yeah, that was extraordinary to have a bunch of advisors, very sort of wise. I'd call them elders, but they're not that elderly. And I think, you know, in terms of us looking for successors to this place, either we would gather around them or encourage them to gather around themselves. An informal body like we had. We were never a legal structure. We had a governing document and bank accounts and second signatories and all the like, but it was never a charity or a community interest company. It was just a bunch of people looking out for us and all our guests.
Yeah.
And they often, you know, exhorted us to do things which went against our nature. And I was actually against following their advice, and we did and realised they were right.
Yeah. Could we move on a little bit to talk about the guests in a bit more detail? And for me, Toby, a good friendship is one that has a sort of good balance between reassurance and challenge. And that was something that you obviously were attempting to cultivate at Windsor Hill. What was it you're trying to inculcate with the guests? What were you trying to do?
I think really give them enough space and peace and work and rhythm and company and good food and lots of sleep, that they could get sort of physically and emotionally and spiritually healed, if you like.
Yeah.
And I mean, you know, healing's a big word, and I know plenty of people would use a different term. I mean, to sort of give them a bit of robustness so that they could go back out to the so-called real world and go back to their families or friends or careers or whatever it was. So that was our aim. And again, in terms of a middle way, you know, I was thinking before sort of talking to you today about, you know, what were the things where there was always needed to be a balance. And one of the ones that was very difficult to judge was between reassurance and challenge.
Yeah.
Between endorsing someone and questioning them. And it takes great sort of tact and insight to know when you need which. And I'm afraid I got it wrong a lot, and other people got it wrong as well. But I think, you know, that in all communities, and well, not all communities, in certain sort of iconic communities and lots of rehabs, there is a culture of sort of, you know, finger pointing and criticism and bearing the sort of stripping bare the person who sat opposite you. We tried to be much less judgmental, but we were sort of, I suppose, sometimes judging people, trying to work out what they needed or why someone's life was in the position it was and how we could help them see a way through that. And I think the role of counsellor or life coach now sounds very professional. You know, you give over your 30 quid or 50 quid an hour or whatever it is, and you have no friendship and it's all very distant and you're told when it's time to leave the room. Whereas the older sort of notion of counsel, of just giving someone advice if they want it, is what we were trying to do. And we were often criticised for not being professionals. And our, as I say in the book, our whole philosophy was almost anti-professional. You know, we believe, like George Bernard Shaw, that professionalism is a conspiracy against the laity. You know, I think a loving family home with good food can do as much good as a 50-minute counselling session. And I think that's why the therapeutic community sometimes were very generous and kind about us, but often they were very spiky and defensive about what we were doing.
Was there ever a danger of it becoming a cult?
No, never. I mean, I was always aware of it. I was always interested in, and I think I got great insights into how a well-meaning community can become a cult. I can see how it happens. And I think I listed in the book, you know, a few occasions in which, you know, people would idealize you wrongly. I always said to them when they got here, don't idealize us and don't demonize us, please. But they did.
Yes.
They often wanted to break ties with their families. They wanted to chuck money at us. You know, I can see how it would have been easy to become a cult. But no, there was never any danger of that. Yes. You know, I joked that we were benevolent dictators. And in sometimes, you know, again, in terms of the middle way, we were very, very egalitarian, extremely egalitarian in terms of, you know, financial contribution, work contribution, who eats what, who does the menial jobs. But it could very quickly become hierarchical when it needed to be. You know, if I needed to breathalyze someone and ask them to leave the space, you know, I was the headmaster. It was very, very clear. So that's another very sort of weird middle way sort of thing. It's sort of about balance, isn't it? And knowing what's needed when. So I joked about, you know, Francesca and I being benevolent dictators, but no, there was never a danger of cult. I mean, I think I'm too sort of, wrong career for me.
There was a great quote, I don't know if it was your line, where it says, the dangerous idealist tries to bend the community to his or her will, while the humble one allows the community to straighten them out. And your narrative of what happened to you in the experience definitely was reflected in that. Your humility seems to come across very much in the book.
Well, I hope so. The trouble is, humility is one of those things, as soon as you think you've got it, you haven't. So, you know, I wouldn't boast about my humility. But I mean, I do think, you know, I never took myself too seriously. It wasn't ever an ego trip.
Yeah. But sometimes you had to be really tough. For example, you had to ask people to leave. That can't have been easy.
Yeah, it was horrible. Horrible. Yeah, very tough. I mean, the first time I had to do it, it was like you stepped over a boundary. Because you start off doing something and you hope you're doing something very altruistic and giving and generous. And inevitably, you're slowly nudged towards, as we've been talking about, more rules, more rigour, more professionalism, and even evicting people. So you do get nudged into positions you don't want. And then, having thought that I'm the rebel who's sort of trying to offer a haven in a cruel world, suddenly you're cast as the cruel world because you're asking someone to leave because they're boozing or using or being physically threatening.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's a difficult one.
Yeah, I'm sure it was. Well, what was really nice to say also in the book, how integral a part your children play, you know, in the whole project. Maybe a good example of this is Benny's letters.
Yeah, well, she was 4 when we started here, and she's now 11. So she's always, well, she's the older, she's always been very blunt and seems like a bit of an ice queen on the surface. But then, you know, would often pen a line or two to someone she could see crying in a corner in a lovely way and sort of lift them up. And there's a bluntness to children, isn't there? A sincerity. I mean, I remember when one guy sitting around the table was talking about his time in prison and everyone was desperate to know why he'd been in prison but didn't want to ask. And of course, Benny piped up and just asked him straight out. And this chap was probably relieved because he was able to get it out there, and everyone knew why, and it wasn't as scary as it might have seemed. So yeah, there's a sort of a generosity, but also a bluntness and sincerity to children.
Yeah.
Which is wonderful. And I think children make the place cheerful and imaginative and creative, and yeah, I think they just completely changed the place. Very difficult, I think, to do this without children around. And that's what the Gospels are about, you know, letting children take the lead often in things. And it's from the mouths of children and of fools and of the marginalised and the forgotten that the truths about God emerge.
Okay. What difference do you think you've made, Toby?
Oh, I don't know. I really don't know. I mean, I think, yeah, it's very, very difficult to judge outcomes, isn't it? And I know, rightly, you know, trusts who are donating money or government agencies or statutory bodies want to know outcomes. They want to know numbers and percentages. But in human nature, you can't be quantitative. And we always try to evaluate what we were doing, but it's very, very difficult. I mean, quite often people would leave and we wouldn't hear from them again. You know, having had a very intense 6 or 9 months, 12 months living with us, you know, and I would send the occasional email, but I didn't want to sort of be on someone's back and phoning them and seeing how they're getting on. So I'd sort of let them drift off. And then very often, it happened to me just yesterday, actually, you know, after years silence, someone would come back and we'd have a long chat about what it had been like for them. And I'd say what it had been like for us having them living with us. And it's a life changer, I think, for almost everyone. And that's not to say it's perfect, because it's all sorts of very, very, you know, sad, even hurtful things happen here. And people leave with a nose out of joint. And it's not that people sort of leave necessarily healed, but it does change people's lives. And I think that's all I can say about sort of, in terms of making a difference. I mean, I get some extraordinary letters. The lovely thing about having written a book about it is that it's managed to touch loads of people who've never been here. And I get the most lovely letters about once a week or once a fortnight of someone, simple stuff, like someone saying they'd set up a website that's doing this and they were inspired by the book, or that they've just joined this network because they've read the book. So, you know, these things ricochet and reverberate, don't they? And hopefully there are sort of core values there that can be useful to all sorts of walks of life and life choices.
Yeah, sure. Well, just a couple more questions, Toby. You've talked quite a lot about balance and the middle way, but what is your understanding of the middle way? You know, your own interpretation of it.
I think it's a big question, isn't it?
It is.
I think I have the way, and I use the definite article deliberately. You know, I think Jesus shows the way. And for someone who isn't on that path, I'm sure it can seem either one of many paths, or it can seem a path which is, you know, ring-fenced with the barbed wire of dogma.
Yeah.
But actually, I think that way not only has a whole constellation of positions, but it takes great judgment and wisdom and insight. It's not like you put your coin in and this way tells you what to do.
Yeah.
So it's a sort of, there's a personal response to that way. And it's a liberating way, not a way that is already mapped out for you and you've got to follow. It's a very, very creative way. I think that's all I can say at the moment, Barry.
That's a great answer.
You know, it's a fascinating concept. I mean, I would love to sort of, yeah, think more about it. I expect we'll have an email exchange maybe in months to come.
Great. Okay. If people wanted to find out more about your work or the Windsor Hill Wood Project in general, in practical terms, how would they go about it?
Well, the risk of sounding very self-promotional, I mean...
Go for it.
Read a Place of Refuge, you know, that's the sort of in-depth description of our sort of communal project. And I've written lots of other books, you know, if people like that style of writing, I've written lots of books, and I'm always happy for people to get in touch with me. I mean, I'm sort of a slow correspondent, but a very faithful one. So, I feel it part of our duty here is to sort of be open, not only to guests who walk through the door, but open to guests who walk through your inbox. So, yeah.
Yeah, and the website itself of the project.
WindsorHillWood.co.uk, and my personal website is Tobias-Jones.co.uk, so it's easy to get in touch.
Brilliant. Okay, well, I can't recommend the book highly enough, Toby, and it was quite inspirational for me, because me and my partner, we presently got our own property up for sale, and we're thinking of going into a sort of co-housing situation, which is maybe not full on as what you're doing, but what, as I said earlier, what was really helpful was the book showed that, you know, living with people, although there's lots of joys and stuff, there's conflict is an element of living together, but it's something that you seem to embrace at Windsor Hill, and that it's not deterred me in any way, but I'm under no illusions about actually living communally. I've done it a bit in the past as well, but it was a big help.
No, I'm glad. You're forewarned. Yeah.
Okay. Anyway, thank you very much for giving up your time today.
Barry. Good luck with the co-housing thing. Let me know how it works out.
Yeah, we've had our place on the market a couple of years now, so it might be a while yet.
Yeah. Okay.
Anyway, great to talk to you. Yeah.
Yeah. Cheers, Barry. All the best.
You can find out more about Middleway Philosophy at www.middlewaysociety.org.